This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Well, for me, it was really interesting seeing your film, or the film of the group, because it reminded me so much of some of the stories of Kairos stories as well, where the question of arranged marriages came up often in our discussions. And I wondered how you arrived at that idea for this particular piece, the headscarf and the arranged marriages.
Well, we actually have participated with Muslim Voices in the first program. And we did a pilot that's very similar to what you'll see the next presentation. And that was more the origins of our community in the United States and particularly in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
So when they asked us to participate, we asked could we participate again, and when we were accepted, we were trying to find something else that we could do. And with you being in the arts, you probably know how much work is involved in just that short clip, how many hours of filming and everything. We decided we actually were going to do a website. So this was not really made to be a film, but our goal was, and actually when I see your pictures, I'm like, wow, that's so awesome. That's what we wanted, where just you saw like kind of the person and you could click on their story. And because there's so much misunderstanding about Islam, we thought, okay, so let's try to take those topics that are kind of the push points for people, you know, the things that they really are interested in or they're really confused about. And what better way to explain it but have people tell their stories.
Mm-hmm.
So we only actually have the marriage and the covering, but we had wanted to expand that, and we had one on loyalty and education. As you can see, the women in the film are very educated. And, you know, kind of branch out into the different topics where there is a lot of confusion. And again, that's an ongoing process that hopefully we'll be able to complete.
And do you think you'll branch out into other groups besides your group in terms of the stories that you collect?
I don't think initially, but mm-hmm. The thing that's nice with the website, which is another thing that attracted us more than the film, is that it's not stagnant. It keeps changing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, once we get ours set up, the idea will be changing topics from time to time and, you know, perhaps talking to other people. Right now we're just trying to get that part done.
No, I thought it was very moving and really interesting to hear the stories.
Good. I'm glad to hear that, because you never know what it's like for other people when you're doing it. You just kind of see, like, sit there and go like, does that make sense? Or?
Yeah, no, I think it was really very powerful.
Good.
Well, one of the things that's really extraordinary about Philadelphia is, and I really enjoyed when I was doing the research for my last book on the Muslim question, I was looking at Muslims in the West, and I went throughout Europe, and one of the things that always made me happy coming home was in Philadelphia, I would walk around the streets, you know, and there's a woman in a niqab in the checkout line, there's a woman jogging, and there are women in hijab in my class, there are women, Muslim women, not in hijab in my classes, and that heritage is so expansive and so broad and so much a part of Philadelphia, and the interweaving of things Muslim in the United States is so very old, you know, from the first free Africans to come to this continent and of course with the slaves, that Muslim presence in all its variety really makes its home in America and frankly is welcome in general in America. And that always made me really happy coming mm-hmm. home, that I'd come into my class and I've got 100, 150 students there, and I look out on them, and they're all different colors, and some of them are in hijab, and some of them are not in hijab, and I don't know, looking at that class, which of my students are Muslim, which of my students are Jews, which of my students are atheists. And that richness of the Philadelphia experience, of the experience of Islam in Philadelphia, and the experience of Philadelphia in embracing this religious diversity, I think is really deeply touching. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think I structured it out of frustration, because for almost all of my adult life, it has been, I've seen Muslims receive a lot of discrimination, just in ordinary speech. There were things that you could say about Muslims that you really couldn't say about any other group in the United States, and frankly, it was worse in Europe. That always sat badly with me, and I wanted to do what I could to speak against that. At the same time, I also saw things changing, and I thought there was a possibility of things changing more and in a good way. And so some of it is me going to Europe and seeing things change, even when people say, we don't want any Muslims. And then you realize they're listening to music that comes from Muslim artists, they're doing all sorts of things, and they'll be having a picnic, you know, in a Berlin park next to a family where all the women are covered. So they really aren't as bothered by it as they think, and I think that's really good. So part of it was discovering the tension between what people said and what they did, and often what they did happily was better than what they said. So a lot of it was that. I also was really uncomfortable with certain things. Like, I felt like women's rights was often used as a cover and as a distraction, so that it would look like here in the West everything was fine, and I didn't think here in the West everything was so fine. So I wanted to speak against that. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about Cairo, because I know Cairo mm-hmm. a little bit. Mm-hmm. Not well, but Cairo is one of those great world cities in which you look out, and Philadelphia is a little bit like this, but we're young compared to the rest of the world, and you see all history layer itself. You see colonialism. You see that French presence and its marks. You see the pharaohs. You fly in, and your airplane circling, and you look out, and you say, it's the pyramids. And so all of that history is layered on itself, and you see that. And you also see the people, and you're walking around, and you look at some policeman, and you say, he looks just like that statue of Akhenaten. How can that be? And that presence of the past, how did you negotiate that presence of the past?
Well, I think it's a very vibrant city. I was first there in 2000 for the Cairo Biennale, and I traveled all through the city as part of that, and I gradually got to know people walking around, and I found the city very full of many, many, many different kinds of people, and often from many different cultures. And one of the things that struck me was the storytelling tradition in Cairo, which is very particular. And so I started going to different places, going to different bazaars, walking in different neighborhoods and so forth and so on. And gradually, actually, the Cairo Stories Project kind of came out of that experience, where suddenly, especially women, would tell me their stories because I was not from there. And many times it was easier for them to talk to me as a kind of sounding board than it was to talk to somebody in their own community. And so, in a certain sense, Cairo Stories found me as a project before I even had it as a project, because I was there in 2000 and 2001, and then about 2 years later, I was invited back to Cairo by the AUC in Cairo, American University in Cairo, to do a project. And I thought, oh, well, I'd already started this project, and so I, unofficially, and so then I started working on it in earnest. But I found the city, I guess I fell in love with the city. The energy, the way it's like a palmoset for all these different histories, as you mentioned, not only the French, but the Germans, the Italians, many, many, many cultures were there. Cairo people also often think of themselves as pharaonic And like many people in the quote-unquote Arab world, they don't identify as Arab because it's actually a Western imposition. And so they really think of themselves, first of all, as Pharaonic, and then secondly, as Kyrian, and then thirdly, as maybe part of the Arab world in some way.
Well, that's been a big controversy in Egypt over time, because the Pharaonic position is a much more secularist position.
Mm-hmm.
Identifying yourself as Arab is more connected to Islam.
But
many people maintain both of those with mm-hmm. perfect equanimity.
Yeah, exactly.
As they should.
Yeah.
And of course, there's the language.
Yeah.
I mean, Arab is a linguistic category. And of course, the word Arab means one who travels. And so it is a constantly moving, and like English, Arabic is a language that incorporates other languages within it. So it's mm-hmm. quite malleable and in many ways open.
Yeah, and Kyrian Arabic is interesting, and one of the issues that we were trying to deal with in this project was I spent about 10 years collecting these stories, and I went back and forth about 25 times and spent, you know, sometimes more than a month or two in each visit. So I really, you know, I feel like I got to know the city and you know, in a very particular way. But when Arab Spring happened, I was just about ready to shoot the project in January. And suddenly we couldn't shoot there. We had to shoot back in New York. And it was very important to all the people working on the project that the voices and the dialect be Egyptian Arabic, because so many of the people that we were working with were complaining about something being in another dialect of Arabic. And luckily, Egyptian Arabic, because of the strong cinema tradition in Cairo since the 20s, in fact, that dialect is actually the dialect of cinema, which is the cinema that still travels all through the region. And so it was relatively easy to hire people to come and bring them over as dramaturges, to be sure that when we were working on the accents, that all of the accents conform to the Egyptian Arabic. And that was a really interesting process for me, to see how that unfolded with different people. So,
have the women, any of the women, been able to see the exhibit, the ones that you interviewed?
Oh, yeah.
Good. Okay.
Yeah, a couple of them, two or three of them actually did come to New York after Arab Spring. And so we flew over, when we were shooting, we flew over about seven people that were part of the project, both interlocutors and two or three of the translators to work with the actors. The project is actors, by the way. The women whom I interviewed really didn't want to be imaged, and so I respected that, and we didn't even take photographs. The project was made using really simple technology, a microphone that was passed between myself and the translator, and we did simultaneous translation. So on the tapes, you can hear the Arabic, you can hear the English, you can hear the translator, you can hear me and the interview subject. And that was a really good method because it made it very friendly, and it also made it very easy to go back into them to see what somebody was really saying. We also, I put together a group of interlocutors in Cairo because I felt like it was really important that the stories be accurate and sort of have a veracity that I wanted to be sure was correct. I didn't trust that I would be able to say, oh, this is what she really means. And so with this group of women, there were about 13 or 14 of them, we would often go through the tapes as a group, piecing together what somebody was really saying as we would listen to it. And then we would often, in most cases, we were able to show the final version of the story to the actual interview subject. And so in that sense, I didn't want to be speaking for someone. I wanted to have their participation in the making of the stories. That was very important for, you know, to me and also to the other people in the project, including the women interview subjects as well.
I'm really puzzled by this. When you said that the women didn't want to be photographed.
Uh-huh.
And I'm puzzled by this in part because there are lots of occasions on which women are photographed. They're photographed in your film. There's a really interesting series of interviews ongoing, many of which are posted on YouTube, called Voices of Women from the Egyptian Revolution,
mm-hmm.
Which is essentially a historical record, an oral
right.
history of women who participated. I myself know a number of Egyptian women artists and scholars and other people, and I'm surprised that so many women didn't want to be photographed. And what did you think was going on there?
Well, a lot of the stories are very intimate. They reveal really personal things about their lives. They didn't always make it into what was actually presented, but I think they were saying things about their emotional experience, their emotional truths that they really didn't want to have used in any way, and so they didn't really want to reveal that much about themselves publicly. And we were really interested in going beyond the stereotypical notion of what it's like to be a woman, and not photographing made people much more comfortable because their voice was just their voice, and they could be, in a certain sense, rather disembodied. And I think it made for a very different kind of conversation than if we had imaged them and had a camera in their face the whole time. And I actually think for this project, it really made a lot of sense. And would that be true if the project was in Western Europe? No.
Why do you think?
Well, because I think in Europe, there's more of a kind of, just like in the States, it's a much more Western attitude towards the representation of the self. And I think still in Cairo, from my perspective, and I'm not a sociologist, this is a very artistically driven project, so I'm not making any claims about anthropology or anything other than my experience with this particular project. But when I was there, I learned a great deal about the differences between women in Cairo, and I wanted to make it specifically about women in Cairo and not Egypt, and say a Western perspective. And for instance, the strength of the family and the strength of the women in the family, where the women really run the families and they have a great deal of power and respect within the family that really has very long tentacles in many, many ways, no matter what class you are. And I interviewed people from the upper classes to the middle class to the working class and to, you know, many people in between, including people in the informal settlements, which are a huge part of Cairo. I'd say half the city lives in these informal settlements, and they're a melange of people from that are refugees, or they've left Upper Egypt and come to Egypt, or they maybe don't have identity cards. Most of them are working.
Some are very wealthy,
and
some of the informal is very wealthy.
Yeah, some of them are, but many of them are not.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, that was an interesting thing: the power of women, and also the power of the close-knit communities that these women were part of. And there was a big sort of there was a potential for self-censorship a lot of the time, I found, and in a way that's very differently inscribed than it is in among Western women, I think. And I found that to be really interesting. For instance,
I want to resist this a little bit.
Okay.
First of all, I want to refuse this idea that I have to be a Western woman. And I'm not sure I know what that means.
Well, I'm just, of course you have multiple identities.
No, it's not a matter of multiple identities. I'm not sure that's really a useful category. And a lot of my work has been directed at that, but I think it's directed in that because, in part, because of the kind of life I live. that the idea that Western and Muslim are separate categories, or that Western and Arab are separate categories, doesn't really sit well with me, because that's not the fabric of the everyday world I live in. Mm-hmm. In the world of Philadelphia, you know, these Muslim women are present in every part of my daily life, and Muslim men as well. But also, so are Arabs, so are people whose first language is Arabic. This is still, in many ways, and I am grateful for it, an immigrant place. And it is shaped by continuing waves of radically different immigration. And it is not a Western place. I want to resist in the strongest way the idea that we have to be Western.
Well, I'm not saying
we have to. I didn't even grow up in the West.
Okay. I'm just trying to make a separation between what I learned, the differences as being, and a kind of more Western perspective. Because I think mm-hmm. the issue, and you bring this up in your piece too, and the group's piece, is the stereotype. And so how do you talk about difference and those polemical ways of the West and a different point of view are very useful as a kind of meta critique about how one might actually unpack some of these issues.
Well, let me ask you both a question, because this is something I've grappled in my own work, and I can tell from the way that your work has been constructed, this is something you had to think about. When one has to talk about Islam, or Islam in the West, or women, mm-hmm. most of all, there are certain things which you are, as it were, obligated to mention. You must talk about polygamy. You must talk about covering. You must talk about whatever you want to call it, cutting, FGM, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. You have to talk about those things. And when I was doing my work, I was really angry about this. I thought, why do I have to talk about these things? Why can't I talk about other things?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because we were, I think the last showing we had, no, I think it was the one we did at the Lutheran Seminary. And they had the pastor, actually from UPenn. And he made a really good point, and I thought a lot about it afterwards. He said, you know, he feels badly that Muslims feel they always have to kind of apologize. And that's kind of what I feel you're saying, like we always have to talk about those subjects as if to justify them or explain them or make people understand them. It's interesting because when I converted to Islam in 1971, really people didn't even talk about Islam. It was rare to even see somebody identify as Muslim. So my journey, when I started studying, nobody had to explain or apologize or anything. It was just me seeking for some place I felt comfortable spiritually. And I found that. And so it's very interesting because I think the conversation dynamics have changed a lot because of, you know, what's kind of the perception of Islam.
Politics, mm-hmm. and also, right, a lot of gender politics has produced that. Mm-hmm. And I was in the 70s, I guess, yeah, in the 70s, in the late 70s, I was a student at University of Chicago with the late Fazlur Rahman, who was a Pakistani theologian, a Muslim theologian. And that, you know, that was a very ordinary part of my education. And no one thought that there was anything unusual about that. And to this day, if I go to Turkey or if I'm in Egypt, people occasionally say, you are a student of Fazlur Rahman. And I say, well, very proudly, yes, I am. but that is one of the reasons why I want to resist that idea that there is this bright line between the West and the rest, or what
well,
it means
I'm not,
to
I,
be.
I guess I'm not, I guess you're a little bit misunderstanding, because I'm really using this as a kind of meta-critique so that I can talk about questions of what the truth of these women's experiences were. And they were very different than I initially had expected. For instance, women from the upper classes had much less freedom than women from the working classes, and especially women who had immigrated to Cairo, because they didn't have the family pressure that some of the other women felt from their families to perform in a specific way. And I found that very fascinating. And some of the women from Upper Egypt who came to Cairo, and there are quite a few women stories that we used to make this portrait of Cairo, were actually women who had left their families and left everything and were reinventing themselves in Cairo by working in various trades, for example. And I found that very fascinating, that they could have the ability to do this in contemporary times, given how so many of the other women I was working with had much stronger family constrictions about what they could and could not do and what they should and should not do. And so that's something that I think is a kind of really interesting difference between what one would expect from a stereotypical point of view and the actual experience of the situation. So for me, we found that really interesting, and that was something that a lot of the women that I was working with wanted to get across in the stories. They wanted the differences to be understood, because also a lot of the conversations that we had in there are one or two stories about this, are the fact that many of the women felt like the West really hadn't worked for them. And when I first started going to Cairo in 2000, there were hardly any women who were wearing the headscarf on the street. It was very, very rare to see that. During the times that I went back, almost every woman on the street was covered in one way or another. And it was a huge sea change. And one reason was because things were unraveling with the U.S. government in Cairo, et cetera, et cetera, and the kind of increasing political tensions. But also among women, there was the real feeling that the West hadn't worked, that they'd tried the quote-unquote Western way, and it wasn't 100% or even 50% of a good way for them. And so the headscarf for these women, each one of them is differently covered, and each one of them has a different relationship, in fact, to the headscarf.
But isn't that really strange? Because, in fact, it's much more controversial to wear the headscarf in many Muslim countries. For example, for many years, in Turkey, you could not attend a university or practice mm-hmm. law or be a judge mm-hmm. if you wore the headscarf. I actually know the law.
Well, Ataturk was really he made a rule
yes,
that you weren't allowed to
he
be
did.
Covered.
But there's also a very, very powerful sentiment against that. And yet in the West, or at least, let me be more specific, not in the West, in the United States and Canada and Australia, but not necessarily in the European West, wearing a headscarf is a perfectly legitimate choice that one sees on the street.
Yeah.
So there's nothing non-Western about wearing the headscarf. It's easier mm-hmm. here in many ways. Mm-hmm. In France, it would not be nice for you.
Very difficult.
Yeah. Here it's okay. So that's not the Western choice. That's what means in a specific political environment.
I'm talking more about Cairo. And I'm just repeating what the women I interviewed told me over, stories.
That's how they viewed it. Right?
Yeah, and that's how they viewed it. And I wanted to make a portrait of Cairo that was specific to Cairo and that's different than Turkey or different than Iran or Iraq. And all of the countries have their own specific histories.
Well, Cairo calls itself Umma Dunya, the mother of the world.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I think that we all have a tendency to compartmentalize things. So I think even for myself, I say the West or, the East, and I think, it's just maybe that's we need to look at that more because mm-hmm. certainly, like you said, the West is not all the same. Europe's not the same as it is in the United States, just like certain parts of even Arab countries are different from country to country. But it makes it easier, just in conversation to kind of say that. But one thing I was thinking of when you were asking about the photos, I wonder if you had done the same thing with men, if they also would have felt more comfortable not having their picture. Because I just think there's a certain, when you're anonymous, you're more willing to talk openly. Mm-hmm. And I think rather than East or West, it's cultural, mm-hmm. more cultural. I think here we have a tendency to be like, we want to be on a reality TV show, and we'll put our whole life history out there, everything mm-hmm. that we do. And I think there's other cultures who are more modest and more, you know, protected. And so to be able to speak and not to know who you are is very comforting and very mm-hmm. comfortable to do. So it would just be kind of interesting to see if men would be the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have loved to interview men too, but there was, you know, a kind of time imperative mm-hmm. to the project, because it was, you know, relatively time-consuming to find people to interview. It wasn't, you know, like people were lining up for this. Mm-hmm. And how it worked was that one person would lead to another person, to another person, to another person. And it was, you know, it takes a great deal of time to do that, and so I had to really limit what I could do realistically. We did more than 215 interviews, which doesn't sound like a lot for 10 years, but
it
actually
sounds like a lot to me.
But it was, you know, quite a lot. It's like, you know, tapes and tapes and tapes.
I think it's a beautiful exhibit.
Oh,
really
thank
nice.
You.
Yeah,
thank
very
you.
Nice.
Well, I really loved what you did too. I thought it was very compelling and moving. So,
one of the things I ran into Judith earlier in the day, and one of the things I talked to her about was the way in which, you know, when you go through the exhibit, there are these headsets. And I really like the headset because, you know, on the one hand, you're seeing this photo, and the way it's set up, you know it's an actor. It's not the person whose story you're hearing. Mm-hmm. And so there's a bit of distance that it's a box. There's a bit of distance that we know you and other people edited it. And it's a bit of distance that it's not the person's voice who tells the story. But there's still that, and so in some ways they're just before you as if they were a kind of exhibit in a museum, and under your control, under your eye. But at the same time, what I like about the headset is the headset ties you to it, and you can't move. That you have to remain, you have a certain kind of compulsory intimacy with that representation. And that, I think, really mm-hmm. marks the sort of the little slice of engagement that everybody tries so hard to find with other people, not just people of different colors, cultures, that it's really hard to find genuine communication with other people and find to hear their stories, to find a true account of their own experience. And that little connection, if mm-hmm. you can make that, it mm-hmm. both is valuable to you, but it also binds you. You can't really move out of it so easily. And I thought that was really evocative, and I was really happy that that tie was there, sign of the tie.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that it's also the intimacy of the voice in your ear that makes you into a listener. And then you have that sense of, this is a story told for someone, by someone, to someone else. And so there's this exchange that happens as you listen, because it kind of gets in your head in a different way than when you're just looking at a picture, especially video, because it's so prevalent now, and it's everywhere. But that's a great observation. I'm worried when I go to digital, completely digital headphones, because the tether won't be there.
I think you need the tether. But I might be kind of old school about this.
Yeah.
Do people get to ask questions?
Yeah.
You all must have had some reactions to this.
Well, I have a question for you. Are you taking this to other places? Like, in what kinds of community places are you screening the project?
We haven't done that yet. And even with the first film we did, I know when they did the first one, they had a lot of community screenings. And unfortunately, we weren't able to. So we have shown it within our community. And it was also shown actually kind of internationally, because we have, our community has a satellite television station called Muslim Television. Ahmadiyyat, and so that was shown when we had our convention. They needed something to fill the time when people are eating, and that it was shown, and it's broadcast in I don't know how many different countries. But we haven't done that much with the community yet, and that's something we really need to do, because it's a great tool, mm-hmm. you know, so I think it could be used well. Again, this wasn't really made to be a film. You know, whether or not we'll use that, or whether or not, you know, we'll just stick with the internet and let people on their own kind of discover it, we'll see. Now, the first film we did, again, was more about the origins of our community. And our community has a really strong history in the African-American community. So when the Women's Auxiliary, we had a program, we tried to have an African history, African-American History Month, we had a program, and then we showed the film there. But other than that, we haven't been utilizing it like we really should.
Yeah, I think you could do a lot with what you've already done in terms of speak outs or using it as an organizational tool in different kinds of, you know, communities, even, you know, work on the street in certain ways.
Do you know the woman who used to be in the military?
Yes. She's one of our members. That was such an interesting story. We never knew that about her, actually, which was...
It's really interesting, but it's really bothering me. I grew up in a military family. And what's really bothering me is she had every right to wear her sweatpants. That the American military does give you the right to observe your religion. And there should have been no dispute. And she should have been able to go straight to her sergeant and say, this is my religious right. I get to wear my sweatpants. And those are very well recognized, heavily adjudicated rights. She had every right. I mean, I'm glad she wore the tights and that worked out for her. But she had a right to her sweatpants.
But it made such a nice... part of the film.
Well, it did. And she
was a very good story.
She was a very sensible person, but I just hope somebody tells her, you got to write your sweatpants.
I will make sure I tell her that. Yeah. I don't think she wants to do a do-over, though.
No, she doesn't need to. But if she has any friends in the military, they can wear what they need to wear.
I have a question for you and for anyone else here who might be Muslim. And that is why do I never hear the call to prayer here?
I'll let my brothers and sisters answer also. We're actually in the process of building a mosque, and it's going to be on Glenwood and Broad. And I don't know whether they'll do that or not. Muhammad, do the call to prayer for Fajr prayer? Do they do that at the mosque?
Inside.
We do it inside. We don't have
it
on the outside. Yeah, well, we always do that inside, but they don't do it outside at all.
They don't do it outside?
No, I don't think so.
In Detroit?
In New York. Okay.
They do it outside in New York?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I have to say, I'm not, in fact, Muslim, but I do miss hearing it.
Oh, it's beautiful.
I would like to hear that.
It is a beautiful, beautiful call, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, I think people... maybe be worrying a little too much about whether that would be disturbing. People should do the call to prayer. I'll be right out there defending you.
Okay.
It's not a problem.
I'm gonna go back and talk to my president and get the mosque open and say, okay.
And especially if you do it in non-amplified voice, nobody can complain.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't talk about human rights and rights of women, but... Well, we did talk about rights of women, but
I have a poem. I'm probably going to get in trouble for this poem, but I really love this poem. It comes from a book, I'm not making this up, called Poetry of the Taliban. And I love this poem. It's probably going to annoy somebody, but maybe not. It's called How Many Are the NGOs? How many are the NGOs? This is just a part of it. If the applicants are girls, they get admitted without an interview. Women in large numbers, but men are few. How many are the NGOs? It was written in December 2007 by a man named Mateula Sarajwal. And I don't have any Dari, so I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, or Pashtun, or whatever his name is. But I worry sometimes about the gaze going on women. Mm-hmm. And I worry about partly about women being a litmus test that you have to pass.
that there's a particular set of rights that that are measured by women and measured by a particular, and I think very narrow, not even Western view of what women ought to have or not have. And I worry about the fact that there's a certain sense in which women are granted a status which is apparently privileged, but which is not in fact privileged, mm-hmm. and which distracts both from our attention to the problems of women here, who are hardly in a position of equality, mm-hmm. however much we might like one, and that it also distracts from American imperialism abroad by licensing it in a certain kind of way. So I think that that particular privileging can be very dangerous, mm-hmm. and something that we have to all negotiate very carefully.
Yeah, I think it's a country by country, case by case, because Cairo is certainly
case by case.
It's full of NGOs, and some of them are just there for their own interests, and it's just their club. Well, who was the Dutch guy who made Enjoy Poverty? What's his name?
Renzo Martin.
There's a really interesting film that Renzo Martin made, which I guess he's repudiated, but it was all about NGOs in Africa, mm-hmm. going around in fancy cars and living a sort of high life. And he erected this billboard that was a neon sign called Enjoy Poverty. And then he does a lot of interviews with people about some of these issues, about the NGOs, and their kind of do-gooder.
He repudiated this?
Well, he repudiated it in the sense that a lot of people took him to task for being so cynical uh-huh. about this, because he was sort of making the film to expose the condition of NGOs in different parts of Africa. But on the other hand, he was also kind of on the back of these people with his art reputation with the film. And so what he did, and he got a lot of criticism, and so he started a foundation, in fact.
Well, and it's very difficult, and because there are good NGOs, and are exploitative NGOs.
Exactly.
And there are NGOs for the privileged and NGOs for the non-privileged.
Yeah, right. And so, it was just an interesting, speaking of NGOs, mm-hmm. an interesting project that, and I think it's online. His name is Renzo Martin? Yeah, Martins. Right, mm-hmm. yeah. And might be interesting to look at. I mean, in Cairo, almost all of the arts organizations have to be NGOs. And so it's very, very difficult to negotiate the bureaucracy and the legality of the NGO post the Arab Spring, both under Morsi and under Sisi now, mm-hmm. because they've made it almost illegal to be an NGO. So it's things really change quickly when the political situation gets shook up, and many arts organizations are really having a hard time being funded now because of that, and most have had to go elsewhere to, they have to put down roots in another country in order to receive money, because they can't do it directly anymore in Egypt.
Or they travel. I mean,
yeah,
I know
they travel.
I know a family of Egyptian artists, the mother, who's the sort of authoritative personality, and her sons, and people in their circle. Cairo has this whole network of artistic and literary ateliers, and they're very active, they're very interesting, they do a lot of political debates, but they also cultivate the arts privately outside mm-hmm. that apparatus. Mm-hmm. And they've just been doing exhibits abroad, essentially.
Yeah. Since
did you deal with the Egyptian art community?
Oh, yeah. I was sponsored by Townhouse.
They're so vibrant.
Yeah. And since Arab Spring and the post Arab Spring events, Townhouse is a gallery that's located in Tahrir Square, like a block or two away. And William Wells, the director, just felt it was too dangerous until very recently to do any exhibitions, because he didn't want people inadvertently walking through the square and running into something And so he basically stopped doing exhibitions until just about 4 months ago. And I was going to do Cairo stories there, but we were planning to project it outdoors, and it's still not, I still could not do it outdoors, and so we're still waiting to do it at another time in Cairo. But yeah.
Although it was also a good time for the arts in a way, the Arab Spring in Tahrir Square and the January 25th Revolution. One of the artists I know there, he's also involved in something called the Complaint Choir, and I mention this in part because I wish that someone would do this here. It apparently is a complaint choir. That is to say, it's a choir that sings political complaints. And I think that this is something which is infinitely transferable. Mm-hmm. I mean,
exactly.
Don't you? I can't sing, which is very sad. But if I could sing, I have a lot to complain about. And don't you think you could do this? Like, it would be really a good political moment. It would be that kind of recitation mm-hmm. that is aestheticized, but still retains its, like, bite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Well, I think the January 25th events produced a lot of really interesting art, and they also made visible a lot of the artists from the Middle East, in quotes, mm-hmm. around the world. And that's been very useful, I think, for artists from the region. And so, you know, a lot of good has come out of it, but also a lot of not so such good has also simultaneously come out of it.